poetic space. How then is it possible that poetic expression has gained such tiny space in anthropology? There is no possible answer. This underground incompatibility of music and rhythmic language might be due to the underground incompatibility of representation and expression. And this is the result of the unavoidable absence of individual bodies in cultural representation, also a Western tradition. Scientists basically maintain a cultural theory of poetry, as if poetry does not speak for itself. Such interpretation is blind for the presence of the expressive voice of the poet, as much as it is blind for the expressive voice of the other, the native, or any individual body, precisely because it does compute with the belief in impersonal urbanity that you once contested in the work of Louis. Now, if we want to detect what it is that makes poetry personal, representational or political, there is one fascinating aspect which catches our ears and eyes immediately. From your description of the difference between perception in the silence of one's own words, on the one hand, and the rhythmic perception of the poetic melody outspoken to the hearer, on the other hand, there is the cultural notion we continuously seem to apply on sounds in general. In fact, it is our construction of phonemics and phonetic which embraces the underground incompatibility between music and rhythmic language. It is the presumption that the collective sound can be separated from the individual body through the phenomena of language, which causes this incompatibility. This presumption is further enhanced by the general belief that the written word can be separated from its original sound without the occurrence of any alteration in its meaning. We have a tendency not to be aware that such separations are in fact political acts of exclusion. The reader listens to his own voice while reading, listens to an external voice while listening. In reading, one's own quiet, one's own body is the source of any phonetic rhythm. In listening to a voice, one's own body becomes the source of what you once called phonemic structure. Sounds become structure, not because it's visually determined by the image of the word, but because it is physically structured by the phonetic stations of the external voice, which refers to an external body, the bodies of others, of culture in the general sense, of physical image which support the psychological barriers responsible for the differentiation of phonetic stations, as you explained in the psychological reality of phonemes. There is very little individual physicality involved in the process, or so it seems. Rather, these phonetic stations, as well as their phonemic structure, present themselves as an autonomous grammar. The irony of the place given to poetry in the literary sciences, but even more so in cultural anthropology, is that its application as a source of representation immediately becomes a political action, whether we like it or not. It remains a personal expression only if poetry speaks for itself, only at the sheer moment of its creation, only in your body, and even worse, as soon as the cold steel of intellect starts cutting its way into the poem, whatever your personal sense of rhythm will be surgically removed, vocal cords first, bone by bone later. Examples of such a process, that is, expressing the passionate temperament and subsequently dissecting it with the cold steel of intellect, can only be found in the Western cultural tradition. I want to alter this opposition into its underground flow of beliefs, which might be closer to what these subsequent positions represent. In this case, I feel that expressing the passionate temperament could be seen as the presence of the body within the text. not because it is that exactly, but rather because it is the way Western thought has constructed the is position. Next, I feel that the cold steel of intellect might be the all too superior belief in a disembodied representation. In the American literary tradition, this disembodiment has led to tremendous problems concerning the act of creation itself. Here, reverence and representation have become so intertwined that language reverence imply at once the impossibility of a genuine culture, as well as the myth of a democratic representation. You once wrote that the past hunts the cultured man, but in the United States, any notion of culture befalls the fate of being reduced to the old country, with no substantial solid ground to even resent the old rhythms and verses of its former poetic rulings. A unique situation has occurred from all this, which might be able to shed some light on the wonderful blasphemous qualities of poetry. One might even say that America has marked political poetry more than any other culture imposed upon the poet. Two poets seem to have crushed the myth of the authorless text, though history immediately reinstalled this myth. These poets are Walt Whitman and Ezra Pound, and I will discuss them in their chronological historical order. Through the work of Walt Whitman, I would like to give you an idea how much individual bodily perception and expression has been denied the American citizen by means of language and culture. The work of Ezra Pound, 1885 to 1972, will serve as an ironic twist of ingenuity, which has primarily served the American national genius, rather than the physical perception and expression of the poet and his political twist towards an anti-capitalist American view. Both poets are well known by the general public, but in their own time, American culture did not allow them much space for expressing what they believe to be the generally good thing of culture. I must maintain that a psychoanalytical approach does not interest me here. We do not actually need models for understanding poetry, as nowadays seem to be the tendency. Neither do we need the psychological established belief that a good poetic creation is the result of a traumatic experience of the poet. I sometimes wonder how Byron, a hidden Don Juan, or Tennyson, a melancholic hypochondriac, would have reacted to the psychoanalytic exploitations of their poetry without themselves ever having been aware that they even existed such a thing as the subconscious suppressing the miseries of childhood. Chris Tafa remarked this in 1991. And you once remarked this apparent misconception with concern to Gerard Manley Hopkins, who, from a Freudian viewpoint, could be called an imperfectly sex-sublimated mystic. Indeed, much of poetry has taken on the role of psychotherapy in terms of the so-called healing process. But such celebration of mischief and misery is rather part of a self-fulfilling prophecy of the idea of culture as a tradition of salvage. Not a very creative approach, and not very genuine approach either. It calls into mind a general feeling that nothing is new, that everything has been said at one time or another, and that the traumatic predicament of the poet is to resort in this mediate, as Ricoeur has put it. Contemporary literary critics like Bouvet, for instance, propose quite another reaction towards history, less murderous, that is. Or rather, the response to the trauma is not a defensive lie against time, a mastering of anxiety by an act of deceitful will, but an open and projective poetry. Furthermore, I would add that the entire idea of resentment poetry as a traumatic experience coincidentally arose simultaneously with the concept of actually having to be paid for one's creativity. And unpopular poetry, as you very well know, does not make a lot of money. We could wonder whether the traumatic mastering of anxiety might not altogether be the result of plain poverty. Such poverty is politically imposed by exclusion, which has little or nothing to do with the overall constructivist approach of culture as programmatic. If it is counterculture we look for, it will be politics we find in whatever form of rhythm, rhyme, and melody. From a viewpoint of the individual poet, it cares less for neither. Walt Whitman wrote in his lifelong poet, Leaves of Grass, that, from a worldly and business point of view, Leaves of Grass has been worse than a failure that public criticism on the book, and myself as author, of it yet shows marked anger and contempt more than anything else. There is more at hand here, more than politics of exclusion and more than the body image of the American citizen. I recall your conclusion on Gerard Manley Hopkins, which states, "And his fuming self-torment is exteriorized by a diction that strains and by a rhythmic flow that leaps or runs or stamps but never walks." And indeed, here we have the quality which excerpts poetry from all other languages. It moves through rhythm. It e-motivates rationality. Whether or not the creation of the poem has been the result of a process which involved careful examination of diction or a spontaneous act of expression, poetry and rhyme touches our body, penetrates our phonemic structures in spite of the psychological boundaries imposed by a culture of physical restraint. The religious poet is usually forgiving his daring sexual assertion. The political poet is not. However, beyond the physical restraints, there is no Freudian interpretation that matters. Merely the fact that poetry moves is enough to make it suspect. It escapes scientific rationality, and what has not been altered over centuries is the place poetry has taken on within the hierarchy of the language process. Quite in accordance with Aristotle, poetry still seems to be the mediate on the road to a higher intellectual acquaintance of knowledge. Whitman himself stumbled on 19th century scientists who proclaimed poetry owing to the special tendency to science and to all its all-endeavoring force, poetry would cease to be read in 40 years. Poetry is willed, and this emotive value has nothing to do with the subconscious traumas. Whitman, who probably knew all of this beforehand, wrote, "I had my choice when I commenced.